collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat. It's the new play that's coming out in December in Soho. Here's Main Stage Theater, and we are thrilled to have Calvin Levels, who has written this wonderful play, join us. Calvin also stars as Jean-Michel Basquiat. And Ira Denmark plays Andy Warhol. And they are joining us on the WBGO Journal in studio. And we will have a little performance coming up in a little bit as well. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us, Doug. It's good to be back with you.
Calvin, we enjoyed you so much in Down from the Mountaintop when you came down to the radio station, and then seeing you in performance, you've got so much critical acclaim from that, but also you're a Tony Award nominee for your work in Open Admission. So we know all the success that has already been bestowed upon Calvin Levels. This is a new project for you, but something that you have worked on for a long time. Tell us how collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat, developed for you.
Well, a few years ago, I went to see an exhibition of Basquiat at the Gagosian Gallery in Chelsea. And after returning home, it hit me that no one had written a piece on Basquiat. And so I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll do a solo show like I had done with my James Baldwin Down from the Mountaintop show that I could easily tour and take it to young audiences at colleges and universities. But as I started working on it, Warhol's spirit came in and pretty much took over. And so it developed into basically a two-character play, even though there are three characters in the play. It's basically a two-character play. So the exhibition at the Gagosian Gallery was really the inspiration for it. He had some beautiful paintings. It was curated wonderfully. And so I worked on it over a summer after seeing the exhibition. And then after having a draft, I decided to take it into the Actors Studio, which I'm a member of, and develop it further, which is the process that I had taken with the James Baldwin play. You know, just worked on it at the Actors Studio over a year or so. And so I thought, oh, well, I need to find an actor to play Warhol. And so I knew Ira from around the studio. I hadn't really seen his work, but as a person, I just bonded with him, and so I thought, well, he probably would make a good Warhol, and I like him, so you know we could work well together. And so I did have a chance after that to go see a show that he was doing downtown, and spoke to him and asked him if he would be interested in working on it with me at the studio to do some scenes. And so over the past couple of years or so, we've been working at the studio, just seeing how the scenes hold up. And, you know, I'd rewrite when they didn't seem to work. And so it's been a great process. And we've been lucky to have the Actors Studio to be able to develop the piece in that manner. So
what did you see in Ira's work that you said, yes, he will be a good Andy Warhol?
Well, it was really just Ira, you know, because I decided to use him before I had seen his work. And it was his spirit. He has this really warm, giving spirit. And he seemed to be very serious about the work around the studio, you know, and the way he would comment on scenes. And so I thought, okay, well, he's serious about the work, you know, and that's what I need. I need somebody that's going to be there, that's going to commit to it, you know, and not be flaky and say, oh, I'll do it, but then wouldn't show up for rehearsals. And so Ira has just been wonderful. I mean, we've rehearsed quite a bit, and he's always there. You know, he's never like, oh, I got to do something. He's there. So I saw that. And that's what I felt would. And then I discovered, you know, how great of an actor he is, you know, and how he gets inside of Andy. But I didn't discover that until later. I really didn't know. I just kind of took a chance on that and just saw the person and the commitment of the artist. And that's what I went with.
Ira Denmark plays Andy Warhol in collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat. What have you learned about Andy Warhol through this process, Ira?
Wow, that's a wonderful question. I can honestly say that at the very beginning, it scared the bejesus out of me. You know, the thought of playing a character in a play is always exciting on many levels, but number one, to play someone who is so known, so iconically known on so many levels. And so as an artist and as an actor, it excited me to have that challenge set in front of me. So what have I learned about Andy? Andy was very deep. Andy was very bright, extremely bright. It may appear to the world that as an artist, things came to him because of the success he had so early. But at the same time, it was all very calculated. It was all something that he dreamed about from the time he was a very young child. And I think probably in answer to your question, the thing that guides me a lot about Andy was that I learned that he was a really damaged child. As so many of us have probably experienced at some point in our lives, something traumatic may have happened. In Andy's case, it did happen when he was very, very young. And that trauma, that damage, certainly had a big influence on how he behaved in life, how he strove to achieve, and along with the success and ultimately with the creation of the image of Andy Warhol, which is what most people are aware of, how he looked and his physical presence. There was this person underneath who lived in a very private and very separate world from the way the world tends to look at him. And that's still something that I discover. I share with Calvin all the time. I discover so many things. I go from rehearsal to rehearsal saying, oh, you know what I just found out? Or you know what I just discovered? It really is fascinating, the breadth of who this man actually was. And it excites me and makes me so happy to have the opportunity to walk into this life and play this man.
A play about two of the most famous artists we've ever known. Interesting that they died just a year apart. 1987, Andy Warhol died at the age of 58, but Basquiat in 1988 died of a heroin overdose at only the age of 27. But you, Calvin, had the opportunity, even though he wasn't with us that long, to actually have a brief encounter with Basquiat. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was living on the Upper West Side, I remember, and I read the New York Times Magazine had a feature article on Basquiat, and he was on the cover, and I read the article, and I thought, oh, this guy is incredible. You know, his work, they showed photographs of his work and his life story, and I decided to go to the exhibition, which was down in Soho on West Broadway at the Mary Boone Gallery. And it was midweek, mid-afternoon. I walked in. No one was there. I took in the entire show. And I turned into a back room of the gallery, and there was Basquiat standing alone. And before I went, after I read the article, I thought, oh, wow, this guy's story would make a great film. Maybe I could play him. And so when I saw him at the gallery, I asked him, I said, John, you know, I'm interested in maybe writing a screenplay on your life. And he just looked at me, gave me this look that I later found out about through other sources, this look that he would give people that it's a look that appears as if he's holding up a mirror and you see the reflection of yourself and the stupidity of what you're saying. And so when I saw that, I just sort of just like, oh, right, okay, and I just backed away. I'm sorry, and I backed away. But it didn't stop me. You know, years later, I decided, oh, I'm just going to write a spec script anyway. And this was after he passed away. And so I wrote a spec script and I did a film underground film that Tom Cello directed called Johnny Suede that Brad Pitt and I starred in. And Miramax picked it up. And so I thought, okay, I have this script. I know it'll make a great film, this guy's life story. And so I gave it to an executive at Miramax. And then someone said, oh, I know how to get to Dennis Hopper because Dennis Hopper was friends with Basquiat and Warhol. He hung out with all those guys, and maybe he would be interested in playing one of the characters. So I got it to Dennis Hopper's people. And the next, I didn't hear anything back from either one of them. And then a year or two later, I saw that they were doing a film on Basquiat, and I said, well, I wonder if that's my script. And so I contacted my attorney, who's a great attorney, and he said, Calvin, you got a slam dunk case here. You know, you want to sue them. And for some reason, I just said, no, I think I'll let them go. I'll just, someday I'll do something about them, you know. And I didn't know what that would be. And so I let it go. And many years later, here we are.
Jeffrey Wright, a terrific actor, played Basquiat in the movie, but you're not really thrilled at how this whole movie came off, though, in the 1990s.
No, a lot of my script is in there. Of course, you know, my guess is that they worked from my script. I don't have any absolute proof of that, but I didn't think it was as raw and gritty as that life was at that time, you know, in the subculture life on the Lower East Side, that the world of art, CBGBs and the Mud Club and the Lower East Side. It's not reflective in the film that they did, I don't think. I think that's where they failed. I think if they had incorporated that into the film, it would have been a better film. But that's just my displeasure with it.
We're speaking with Calvin Levels, who is the author of the play collaboration Warhol and Basquiat. Calvin plays Basquiat in the new play that's at Here's Main Stage Theater in Soho. And Ira Denmark is also joining us. He is portraying Andy Warhol. During that time, Ira, where these two artists got together, and Calvin just mentioned, it was a magical time when these artists were all together. Didn't always turn out to be a magical experience, but will we ever see anything like that ever again, where you have this collaboration of geniuses really getting together and producing work?
I think there will be times like that on the planet again. I think maybe we're going through a time of that now, where there is a class of people in our society and around the world that feel disenfranchised from the mainstream, and with their energies, and especially with social media these days, and the fact that so much communication can go on under the radar of the elite classes and stuff, there is an opportunity for people with a great deal of energy and passion, a youthfulness, to coalesce and come together and create. And I mean, we've seen that in the last three decades with the hip hop and rap movement. I think that has a lot of the same kind of energy that we're talking about, or Calvin was referring to in terms of what Basquiat was dealing with. Andy dealt with that same kind of energy in the 60s with the factory and the drugs and all of the young artists and people of who desired to be in that kind of subculture at that time. They weren't mainstream at all, but yet they attained a notoriety and a sense of purpose in that time period. So I think currently there probably are many, many different fields of artists working together that we may not know about yet, but they'll come up to the surface, and we'll see them as we move forward. I think in humankind and as we evolve as a people, I think there will always be that sense of artistry, of I see my vision of the world, the vision of how our people, our world population is growing and moving forward can be expressed in a way that no one else is showing. And I think that, again, as I've been saying, I think that's possible and probably exists today.
I think we really see it a lot in jazz, you know. You see, even Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett, you know, I mean, it seems to have always been there in jazz,
right.
And it's not going anywhere to this day. You see it constantly, collaborations among great artists, you know, so it's around, comes in waves.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. And in film projects too, and theater projects, mm-hmm. People always coming together, different people, different experiences, like with having Lonnie Price come on as our director. Lonnie has a whole experience as a solo, as an artist, as an actor, and now as a director, lots of musicals, and this is a different kind of piece. So the collaborative life is still there for all of us, and I think we get excited about having energies that are maybe a little different. I knew even Calvin and I, we have similar things that we can connect and relate on, and then yet we have very different energies that kind of come in, and part of our experience of working together is the sharing of that.
So when you have the iconic pop artist Warhol and the neo-expressionist painter Basquiat getting together, Ira, how did Warhol change Basquiat? At first was a critic, kind of, almost, then became a mentor.
Definitely.
Right? How did he change him?
It's a good question. How did he change Basquiat? I think exposing him to the more mature side of the business of the art world, which was something Andy was very focused on. Other than creating art, he was really focused on how do I make money? How do I become successful at the business of that? And in the course of the 6 or 7 months that the play covers with 1985, that becomes a part of our conversation quite often, which is, you know, I'm very aware of the business of art. And yes, you as this genius artist don't discount that. That's very important as to your own success as you move further, because there are these forces within the art world that will take whatever you're bringing to the table and leave you behind if you're not smart enough to protect yourself. So that was definitely an area that I, as Andy, and I know in the writing as Andy had a mentor concept in terms of, I'm going to help this artist manage the way into the art world from beyond being this overnight success into having a sustained and long career.
Andy also tried to, Ira just put that beautifully, but he also tried to get John off of the drugs. And that was a real change for Andy because, you know, back in the factory days, you had a lot of that going on, a lot of people overdosing and dying, Edie Sedgwick and a number of people. And at that point, Andy didn't really do anything about it. He didn't say anything to those people that we know of. He didn't try to stop them for whatever reasons. But with Jean-Michel, he decided, okay, I'm going to step in here and I love this guy. He's a genius artist. He would be a great loss to the world, a great loss to me. Let me try to do something. And he tried. He did try, but unsuccessfully.
Yeah, and also in that, listening to Calvin clued me into the fact that Andy really had a love for Jean-Michel. Beyond, we're not talking about an overall sexual or intimacy kind of love, although probably in Andy's fantasy, I believe that he probably would have liked for that to have happened at some point. But that never materializes in our world. But there's this love for the artist and the energy that this artist is bringing to the world and speaking on levels that have not been spoken to before, and the energy that Andy perceives this artist giving off was so magnetic, and it just drew him into this being. Especially Andy at this time is 55 years old. He's seen everything. He's been there. He's done it all. So at this point in life, when something crosses his path that gives off this kind of radiant energy, interesting, Basquiat's documentary is called The
Radiant Child.
The Radiant Child, because he gave off such an incredible energy. energy, of love, of peace, of brilliance, absolute brilliance, that Andy was fascinated by this and only wanted to be the mentor and also the father, all of the things that he could possibly be to enhance John's life and bring him into a peaceful world. And as Calvin said, trying to rid him from the drug world was certainly a part of that as well. So,
and they had a great time together, Andy and John. I mean, they really vibrated on the same frequency, you know, like water seeks its own level.
Yeah.
They were both geniuses, and they were both really educated in art, even though John was young. You know, he started going to museums. He was a member of the Brooklyn Museum at the age of 5 or 6. I saw his membership card at the Brooklyn Museum. And his mother took him to all the museums, and he started drawing with her at an early age and reading about art. And Andy was highly educated in art. And so they could speak in those terms together of high art. And Andy really made John laugh a lot, you know, which was not an easy thing to do. And so John was very attracted to Andy because of that. That they were also attracted to each other because, you know, Andy is at the top of the art world. And Jean is this meteor shooting up to the top of the art world, breaking through that stratosphere. And even though at that period in 85, Andy isn't as celebrated as much as he was before, Andy felt, okay, here's a guy that's on the way up. Let me attach myself to him. Maybe I can get back into the scene. And then John was using Andy in the same way. Here's a guy who everyone says is the king of pop. If I'm with him, I'll be recognized as maybe a king of the art world. So,
we're speaking with playwright Calvin Levels, who has written the new play collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat. And the two stars are with us here, Calvin Levels playing Basquiat and Ira Denmark, Andy Warhol. Calvin, we've lost so many iconic artists at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Jackson, Prince. Basquiat was just 27. What did we lose when we only had him for that short period of time?
Oh, we lost a mammoth artist. I mean, this guy at 27 he was so prolific. When he died, he had nearly 2,000 pieces really beautiful pieces that he had created. But what we lost was this great philosophical mind and truth tailor. You know, teller. In a way, he reminds me of James Baldwin, you know, where he would see that truth and nothing would hold him back from telling the truth. And you see it in John's work with the African-American heritage. He loved jazz. He loved bebop was his favorite of all the jazz music. And I think he got that from his father. His father used to play jazz around the house. They lived out in Brooklyn. His father bought a brownstone out there. And so his father would play jazz, and he picked that jazz up from his dad. And he would play bebop while he painted, you know, and dance around to Miles and Diz. And Charlie Parker was one of his favorites. But he incorporated this history of this great culture into his work. I mean, even going back as far as, you know, ancient Egypt, you know, he would incorporate just so that's recognized, you know, when you go to a museum, because you hardly see that in museums. You know, major museums hardly even purchase African-American artists, you know, to this day. Basquiat's work has not really been purchased by that many museums. They have some on loan pieces, but still, in a way, they don't want to support him. And he wanted to bypass that. So he was a real activist in that way. You know, he was a great activist but also, you know, Basquiat painted in a way that he went straight to the essence of things. He just got rid of all the peripheral stuff and just had the essence, the bare bones minimal in his work. And you see that essence of what he's talking about and what he's painting and the combination of images and thoughts that are in the painting and the writing. You know, he was a poet. He started out as a poet, you know, writing street art, graffiti under the name Osamo in the lower Manhattan, below 14th Street, Soho and East Village, West Village, those different places. And he was highly recognized for that when he was 18, 19 years old, his poetry. And he became a star. You know, the Village Voice was, who's Samo? No one knew at the time who Samo was. Who is Samo? Who is Samo saying all these profound sayings? Because they were profound. And so we lost that. We lost this great mind and this courageous spirit, this dedicated artist in the true sense of telling and recording history truthfully. You know, it's one thing to have this mythological history, you know, that has been rewritten and put out there to try to make the world, to whitewash it in a sense. But it's another thing to have the truth of history, which is what we need. We really need that, especially we see that today with this political race, you know. So we lost this great mind and great dedicated artist.
And if I can jump in there too, I think it's an interesting cross section between the two artists and the fact that Andy is very much responsible for the concept of the original artwork being repetitiously created out there in the world, manufactured, mm-hmm. just like in the music industry. Even though we lost Hendrix and we lost Joplin at very early ages, we have their recordings to remind us and also enlighten us and educate us as to who these greats were in their time, as we do as well across so many jazz great artists. And so because of what Andy was able to do in the 60s by creating this, you know, pop art, op art world where so many pieces were duplicated and made into so many pieces of art that become posters and people can buy on postcards or T-shirts. We now have that with all of Basquiat's art. So even though he died at a young age of 27, his voice is not going to be forgotten. And Calvin probably knows better than I, but I mean, his works now are being auctioned off and being sold for tens of millions of dollars, just like Andy's. I mean, that's a level of attainment for an artist who only lived to the young age of 27, which is truly remarkable. What was his last painting?
His last piece was auctioned, I think, earlier this year for $57.6 million.
I came in second in the auction.
Right. No, and Warhol is over $100 million.
Wow.
At auction. And this is a guy that still the major museums don't want to purchase his work. They'll purchase less known and celebrated artists, but not Basquiat, which I think has a racial overtone to it, obviously. So,
and, you know, with that in mind, I was thinking as you kind of even read my mind when you were talking about the whole Samo, you know, phenomena. Who's Samo?
Mm-hmm.
He had already established himself as Samo.
Right.
And so there was no way of going back. It's like, well, he's not brilliant. We know he's brilliant. But do you think he would have had the same recognition if they would have known his background before they knew his work?
Even though people didn't know who Samo was, people in that culture knew who Basquiat was. Basquiat was the king of that subculture world at 18, 19 years old. I mean, he put himself right in the midst of it.
So that was before the whole graffiti thing then?
That was before and during the graffiti thing.
Okay.
Even though they didn't know who Samo was, that world knew who Jean-Michel was. And they all looked up to him as this emerging talent person, because he was right there in the Mud Club and those different places where he was at the epicenter of the art world, music and art, and they all looked up to him, you know, just as a person that appreciated this world and was trying to move things forward in that world.
So his ethnicity really wasn't any kind of roadblock for him in that.
Well, among that culture, it was in the major museums and the galleries.
And really still today is what you're saying.
And still today. But amongst that world of artists and that subculture, which has less of a tendency to be prejudiced, you know, that world sort of just appreciates the truth and art. But once you get outside of that, then that's when he ran into problems to this day.
Calvin Levels and Ira Denmark, the stars of collaboration Warhol and Basquiat, running from December 2nd through the 22nd at the Here's Main Stage Theater in Soho. Mm-hmm. And the two actors here have graced us with a chance to hear them read some of the play for us and portray Basquiat and Warhol. If you want to set up the scenes.
Yeah, first? I'd like to set up the scene. This is a scene where it takes place in Warhol's studio. And at the beginning of the scene, Warhol is alone and he's viewing some film footage, early band rehearsal of the Velvet Underground, which is the band that he produced their first album. And so he's there, considering doing a music video because the Velvet Underground is taking off again, but he's not being cut in. So he's thinking, I'll make a music video and do it myself, and I'll profit from it. So he's there alone, and he's waiting for Jean-Michel to come over and work on the collaborative paintings, which, you know, they did pretty much on a regular basis during this time period. And so he's there alone, and he's a little perturbed, and then. You know, and Jean walks in and he says, "Hey, Andy. I'm sorry I'm late. Did the Times reporter come by? Andy, did you speak with the New York Times? What?
I can't believe you.
What?
You know what?
No, I don't.
Oh, don't play Mr. Innocent with me. It doesn't become you.
Andy, what the hell's going on?
That's what I want to know.
Well, maybe if you told me what's happening.
Why? So you could tell the New York Times?
Oh, you think I said something to the Times?
You did. You told the Times all the news that's not fit to print.
I didn't tell them anything that's not fit to print.
Oh, no? You didn't say that you're more disciplined and driven than I am?
No. I mean, all I said was that you just like to do your one hit on the collaborations, and I have to prod you along to do more.
Prod me along? What am I, stockyard cattle? And where do you get off telling the New York Times that we don't have a gallery for our collaborations yet? What's the use of agreeing on a strategy if you're not going to abide by it? John, your loose tongue has just undermined everything that we were building.
I don't think so, Andy. I think a mention in the Times will help get us a top gallery.
That is not the point. You made the interview sound like it's the Jean-Michel Basquiat show.
Andy, the article is about me and my upcoming show.
Oh, really? I thought it was about new artists.
No, I'm being featured in the article. They're using my photo on the cover.
Wow. Isn't that something? Oh, so now that you're famous, my say in what we're doing doesn't matter anymore.
What, are you jealous, Andy?
Why would I be jealous? We're working together. I thought, making decisions together, not separately, the plan was to keep our mouths shut and let Bruno sell the collaborations out of his warehouse to his best clients until we found a gallery.
well, I'm not interested in selling these pieces out of Bruno's warehouse or someplace. You know, I want to do a gallery show with you.
We can do both. We can have Bruno pre-sell some of the pieces that will also hang in the show.
No, Andy, look, you know, we should do what's best for us, not what makes Bruno rich.
Oh, so now you know the art business better than I do.
No, I don't.
Now just... you're better at everything that has to do with art than I am, aren't you?
No, Andy.
No, no, then why did you tell the New York Times you're a better artist than
I am? I didn't say that.
Oh, no, don't lie to me.
I'm not lying.
She played me the tape, John. Andy inspired me for years, but now I inspire him. I got Andy back into drawing again and using a brush again instead of just doing that silk screening stuff. Andy has always been my idol, but I know in the end I will be more famous than him.
Oh, is there something wrong with aspiring to become more successful than your idol?
Oh, yeah, and why did you tell her that I kept blowing you off for years when you first tried to make contact with me?
Because it's true.
It may be true, but you didn't have to tell her.
You kept avoiding me, you know, like I was some kind of street urchin or something.
But weren't you?
No, come on. I was just trying to make it. I mean, Truman Capote blew you off for years when you stalked him. And who's more famous now?
I am.
Exactly.
And that's another thing about my Truman obsessions. Those are meant for your ears only, not for the New York Times.
Andy, what is the difference?
About 10 million people. Oh, Jean, if you had played your cards right, this Times article could have made you the most important black artist of all time.
Oh, no. Oh, now I'm a black artist. My art doesn't compare to that of white artists. Why don't you just say what the rest of them do about me? That I'm primitive. A monkey, a wild boy raised by wolves, locked away in Anina's basement, turning out paintings. Andy, if I was white, I'd be considered an artist in residence instead of all that other crap. They're just racist, man.
So that's why you threw me under the bus, because you think I'm a racist.
Now, when you say things like most important black artist, you're perpetuating that white supremacy crap.
But you are black, and you are an artist.
And you're Slavic American, and you're gay. Have you ever heard anyone refer to you as Andy Warhol, the most important gay Slavic American artist?
I kind of wish somebody would refer to me as Andy Warhol, the most important gay Slavic American artist.
No, that's ridiculous.
But that's who I
am. That's not who you are. It's a label. It's a label designed to make you less valuable than those labeled white Anglo-Saxon Protestant straight male. It's all crap, Andy.
Oh, Jean, you are taking this race thing too far. It's just art.
What are you talking about? It's just art. Andy, since we've known a man, artists have been the ones that record history. I mean, how many people go to museums to see what past civilizations were like, huh? And how many black people do you see represented on the walls of those museums? I mean, even the ancient Egyptian art, that's been whitewashed. There's no acknowledgement of that great culture deriving from the deepest, darkest parts of Africa. You name me one black artist whose artwork has been purchased by any major museum. One.
There must be some.
None. You know, but Herb Shore, you know, he's thinking about gifting MoMA and Whitney one of my pieces. And Andy, if they accept it or if I'm ever purchased by any of those museums, I am going to make damn sure that people experience the celebration of that great black heritage. And I could care less about people criticizing me for referencing Ali or King or Bird or Tut. I mean, no one criticizes you for painting Marilyn Monroe or Elvis Presley or Jackie O. You know, I'm not saying that you personally have to include black subjects in your work. I'm just saying...
I did a portrait of Michael Jackson. Oh, besides, it doesn't matter what I paint. You're just going to paint over it anyway.
But, Andy, you make such beautiful corporate logos that cry out for defacement. You don't want me to paint over them? Don't make them so beautiful.
Oh, no, 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 no. You're not going to charm your way out of this one.
I'm not trying to charm my way out of anything.
Well, you should be.
Andy, look, man, you really are just being overly sensitive.
Right? Overly sensitive?
Yeah.
Overly sensitive. You told the New York Times that you can draw better than me.
No, I know I didn't say that.
I heard it with my own two ears.
Yeah, well, I must have been really high or something, because nobody can draw better than you, man. I mean, your drawings are masterful. I mean, the honesty of your line absolutely blows me away. I mean, there's no self-consciousness.
Oh, Jean, would you quit the bull, huh?
I'm being serious. I mean, Picasso spent his entire life trying to capture that childlike innocence. Admit it. You're a master, Andy, that was a prolific child protege.
Well, I wouldn't say that I was prolific.
Any child whose mother gives them a Hershey's candy bar for every drawing completed has no choice but to be prolific.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised you didn't tell her about the chocolate bar, too. Did you?
No, I mean, not exactly.
What do you mean, not exactly?
Well, you know, because you've always had a gift for drawing. You know, a major gift. She just wanted to know why you quit.
And what did you say?
I told her what you told me.
Which is?
That you stopped, you know, because when you were trying to break into the art scene, the so-called real artists of that day, they didn't just draw. I mean, they poured their tortured soul onto the canvas in some abstract way. Oh, and Pollock, Rothko, and all those guys, you know, how they wouldn't let you into their inner circle because you were gay. I mean, even Rauschenberg, man, he distanced himself from you.
And Bob, he was the biggest queen alive. Both Bob and Jasper, pretending to be macho like the others so that they would be accepted and have careers. They were just hypocrites.
Yeah, Andy, but who ended up changing the entire art scene?
Oh, Jean, it was changing anyway. That whole abstract school was bordering on becoming academic. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it is great work. Great work. I just don't believe people want to be working that hard when they're looking at a painting.
Well, no one certainly has to work hard looking at soup cans. I mean, where did you get that idea, man?
Well, where I get most of my ideas, other people. I can't remember who it was, but someone once told me that I should paint something that I know, something that I see every day. Well, I've been eating Campbell's soup ever since I can remember. I think I was 12, maybe 13. My mother got cancer. I was so afraid that I would lose her the same way that I had lost my dad. That every day over my Campbell's soup lunch, I would pray to God for him to save her. And he did. Campbell's soup. I just had to paint all 32 flavors over and over and over. Good. Campbell's soup.
Andy, look, man, if I said something to hurt you, I really didn't mean to, I'm sorry. Andy, you know I have nothing but love for you.
You always hurt the ones you love.
Yeah, my mom always says that.
Have you seen your mom lately?
No.
You know, you need to call her. You should invite your mom to come paint with us when she gets out of the hospital. She won't tell any of her friends what we're working on, will she?
And who's she going to tell? The patients in her psych ward?
Well, you never know who's there. Some of my closest friends are in mental hospitals. Or they should be.
Well, I'll invite her. She'll love that. I mean, she really will. Thank you, Andy. Andy, I really am sorry for what I said.
Will you promise me that you'll never do that shit again?
I promise you. Oh, I want to say something that you probably won't like.
What?
But promise me you won't get angry all over again when I say it, okay?
What?
I need to prod you along so we can finish this piece.
That piece, well, looks pretty much done to me.
Pretty much done? Mm-hmm. Andy, we both need to take another pass at that before. See? You just like to do your one hit, and that's it. I mean, for someone who wants to be the most famous artist ever, I mean, you sure like easy.
Oh, Jean, you are such a taskmaster. Is that any way to treat your idol? Move over, Rover. And let the stockyard cattle take over.
End of scene. So, yeah, so that's a scene that happens between them. And we have many more of those.
Wow. Calvin Levels and Ira Denmark as Basquiat and Warhol. Collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat. You can really feel so many emotions in that scene of mutual respect, love, jealousy, I mean, you're the playwright. Why am I picking up all these? Well, you know, betrayal. What a wonderful play you've written, and we really look forward to seeing it. Even when you have a reading like that, mm-hmm. what goes through your body as both of you do this scene? What are you thinking? What are you feeling?
Well, you know, there are personal things that I find that come up that you personally relate to, that you may have experienced, of betrayal and of love and bonding. And so, you know, the even though it's a reading, the body and the mind at times taps in and just experiences those emotions. And you know, what you want to happen is this freedom, this spontaneity that comes when you launch into the scene. You kind of just want it to take over. But that only happens when you're so well versed in the scene. You know the scene well enough that you can sort of throw away any preconcepts of it and just be in the moment of what's happening at that time. And that's what you live for in the work. And sometimes that happens. And when that happens, it's a wonderful thing, because then it really feels personal for you. And like I said, those personal emotions and the memory just of those personal experiences that may have occurred in your life just flood you and come up. And you can just channel that right into the dialogue.
Ira?
Yeah, very well put. It's getting in touch with that place that we all live at. For Andy, at the very beginning, the sense of betrayal. You know, we all have so many experiences in our lives that we can look at and say, okay, I remember what that felt like with that person or that business associate or whatever, boss, personal partner or friend. And then that becomes the springboard to a whole wealth of emotions and feelings that I, as the artist, have. And as Calvin was saying, the goal is to allow that springboard then to open up a whole world of possibilities, where all of a sudden in the middle of a scene, an image starts to flash through your mind of when you were 10 years old and someone in school hit you on the back of the head because you said something, or, you know, these new things that somehow all align with that feeling start appearing for you, and the freedom as the artist to allow those moments and those feelings just to keep growing, and like a flower opening up and blooming for you. So you wind up going down a road, and you know, for an artist, sometimes in a scene, all of a sudden you're taken to a place, and it's like, oh, how do I get back from, you know, what's the next line that I have? Mm-hmm. And I suspect it relates to being a jazz musician.
That's what I was just thinking. You finishes, I talk about, you know, you think a train or miles, and they were really well trained on their acts, on their instruments, and that's what you need as an actor. You know, your body is your instrument, and you have to really fine tune it, and you really have to play that music and do those exercises, those scales, over and over again, and know the music backwards and forward, so that when you get into that moment of performance or even a rehearsal, that you can go to a place where you can just let go. You know everything well enough, and you can tap it's a creative force. It's like a God space where you can just let that creative energy come into you. I mean, we experience that with Train all the time. He gets spiritual on us, you know, whether it's a My Favorite Things or Naima, or you know, you can feel it. You say, man, this guy is just giving it to it. It's coming through him, And he's a channel. He's a channel right now, just letting it flow. And that's, you know, that's what you want in the work. But it takes work, you know. And we know that those jazz musicians worked day and night, whether it was Rollins out on that bridge, you know, just blowing night and day and not performing and then saying, oh, okay, I've done this for 5 years. Now I'm ready to get back to performance. And then it's just at a whole other level because they become free. They become free and they can tap into the spiritual. They can tap into the philosophical. They can tap into the highly emotional, the highly intellectual, and say and feel and express that vividly, vividly. And that's talent to be able to do, to express vividly, so that the receiver is gone. They're gone, you know. We know we're trained. We're gone. We sit there. You can't help but to be gone, you know. And so when you go to the theater, you want to be transported. And only great artists can do that, you know, because they do the work necessary to transport you there, to have the mechanism to transport you there.
So yeah, it's
they transport themselves.
Yeah, we're riffing. Yeah, we get to the world where you riff. I know one of the, in my lifetime, now that I'm 65, one of the great artists of the 70s and 80s was Joni Mitchell. And when she came on the scene with her poetry and her music, it was so fascinating. And then through the 80s and 90s, she migrated and evolved into where her later works were all about jazz and exploring music. And then, of course, Herbie Hancock a few years ago doing that great The Joni Letters album, which won Album of the Year, fabulous jazz album and extraordinary work. So there's an artist whose career kind of spanned it all, so it relates to what you're saying. And we find that, you know, when we get into riffing and being in the scene, that becomes so exciting for us. And I think as every live performing artist, music and theater certainly live in that world. Maybe even circus performing. You know, there is a place that we aim to get to, and it's that world where we can let the all of the thoughts and the limitations of day to day life just kind of disappear for a while and allow us to have the believability to live in the magic of the riffing, and trust that will fill. And I believe, as a live theater artist, that when that happens, we create a relationship with the audience, and there's this flow of energy that just goes back and forth, and each is feeding the other and elevating and educating and lifting everyone at the same time. So by the end of the experience, everybody's wasted because it's such an extraordinary moment that can't be recaptured in any way. But for that moment, while it existed, it certainly had that kind of vibration.
Yeah, and
I
think that's
for
what happened with Basquiat. You know, when he used that music to paint by,
yeah,
you know, he used it to be transported. And he actually spoke about that, you know, the magic that happens. And I know personally that has happened to me listening to Train, especially. One of my first experiences with John Coltrane was I was young. I was maybe 13, 12 or so. And, you know, I was trying to be a grown-up. You know, I had an older brother, and he was smoking something. And and I said, hey, you know, I want a little of that. I want to get it. And he wanted to teach me a lesson. You know, he says, okay, well, if I give it to you, you're going to have to smoke the whole thing, right? So I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. So, you know, I went in the bathroom. I made my way through about a quarter of it, right? So he's got a Love Supreme blowing on the stereo system. So I make my way from the bathroom onto the porch. We lived on at the second story of this house, this old house in Cleveland, Ohio, with this huge maple tree that enveloped the whole entire front of the porch. So I made my way into this lounge chair, and I just sort of collapsed into, and Train is blowing Love Supreme. And then all of a sudden, I am gone. I am so gone. I mean, I can't move a finger. I can't move a leg, my lip. And I'm paralyzed, but I'm totally conscious. I'm not only totally conscious, I am super conscious. train has transported me to a place where I can now, I see this energy field around my body. And I feel it also, I can feel it. I can feel it pulsating. It was sort of like these three rhythmic pulses. And I could see it. And it had a color scale to it. And I was just terrified. I was terrified, but you know, and eventually I came out of it. And years later, I realized, you know, that that was my aura that I could see and feel. And train took me there, you know, with that love supreme. I only wish I was smart enough to realize it and really enjoy it and use it consciously, you know. But yeah, you know, that's what great art does.
You're talking about great art and taking you to a place. Not only do I get to sit here and hear both of you talk about your love of jazz and how it impacts your work, but not only do I get to see two great actors portraying this, but I just felt like for about 10 minutes that I had Jean-Michel Basquiat and Andy Warhol in the studio with me. Right here on WBGO. That was a magical moment, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a nice compliment. I appreciate
thank
that.
You.
Really powerful stuff. Before I let you go, a couple more things I wanted to ask. What has it been like working with Lonnie Price and knowing that you're the playwright, you're the star, and now somebody comes in and is going to mold this in their way? How's that dynamic for you?
Well, I'm really excited to be working with Lonnie. We've just done preliminary work. We haven't done the nuts and bolts of rehearsals yet. Lonnie is currently away in Norway, and he'll be back soon. But just speaking with him, meeting with him, I mean, this guy is just so highly perceptive and such a beautiful being, you know, and I find that in my experience, the greats are usually that way. They don't have to throw up any smoke screens or anything like that. They're very confident with themselves, and so they can just be loving. Baldwin talks about that. He says great art comes out of a place of love. You know, you can't create great art without having great love. And so I see that in Lonnie, and I'm just so excited and lucky to be working with him. You know, he's just he's a master. I can tell he's a master. And Ira has had the opportunity to work with him before. If Ira wants to talk about that,
yeah, I had the good fortune back in the 80s when I lived in Los Angeles to met Lonnie. In those days, I was very good friends with his sister at the time, Jody Price. And not too many years after that, an angel in my life, someone who I had known over probably about 7 or 8 years at that time, her name was Toni Kaye. She was an angel and a mentor, and in many times in my life, she turned out to be a wonderful friend. I got a call. She was up in Toronto and choreographing a show that was being produced in Toronto and was going to make its way to Broadway. It was called Durante, and it starred Lonnie Price, and there were two other actors from America. The rest of the cast was Canadian, and Tony called me and said, we've seen everybody in New York, and the producers weren't happy with anyone, and we've seen everybody in Toronto, and I told them about you, and they would like to meet you and fly you up to Toronto to see if you could understudy Lonnie for that production, when all of that came to pass. So we had a number of months of working on the same show. And of course, since I was understudying him, we didn't actually have a lot of time that we got to spend together, but we became friends over those months and had seen each other occasionally over the years. So I have a very positive and loving feeling going forward that it's so nice to be reacquainted with a friend and a collaborator now in this particular situation. And I think the three of us are just going into some wonderful wonderfully uncharted territory, and I'm so excited about that because I know from the years that Calvin and I have been working, and I know from where Lonnie is right now in his life, that it is about the energy and it is about the creation of art that will affect and touch an audience and elevate them and enlighten them. And maybe people will come and see the show that don't know about Jean-Michel Basquiat or don't know about many of the things I've discovered about Andy that I can share. And I'm sure Lonnie will bring his whole point of view about it. So it's a very exciting time for me, and I'm sure it is for Calvin as well.
Yeah, Lonnie came onto the project because I had contacted a Broadway producer about the play, possibly producing it on Broadway, and he read the script. I'm not going to say his name, but he's a very prominent Broadway producer. And he read the script, and he's like, Calvin, I really, really love this script, you know. Can I send it out to some people, you know, so forth? And I said, yeah, you know, and I said, I'm self-producing it right now at a theater down in Soho, but I don't have a director. And he says, I think I know somebody. And so he contacted Lonnie, and he said, get the script to Lonnie. And Lonnie's very busy. You know, he's doing Sunset Boulevard and all these big Broadway shows. And I got him the script, and a couple of days later, Lonnie got back to me and said, I love the script. I would love to work on this. And so he's come on board, but we're just so excited, Doug. I mean, it's just everybody is coming in, and all the right pieces are being put in place. So
yeah, safe to say, then we could see this on Broadway as well. Then
let's hope. Let's pray.
Okay. I'll go for that. Sure. Yeah.
Ira Denmark, you've had a wonderful career and
thank you.
Many, many shows that you're associated with. But I wanted to touch upon, you toured nationally in Fiddler on the Roof, and I know that means a lot to you. Tell us about that.
Golly, Fiddler was one of my earliest experiences with the real life of the theater. And by that, I mean, I remember seeing the show. I was raised on in Deer Park, Long Island. And in high school, probably around junior year, with a couple of other friends, our parents would let us cut school occasionally on a Wednesday afternoon so we could take the train into New York to see a Broadway show. And Fiddler was one of the first shows that I saw. And I remember it just came, it took me away. It took me so away that at the end of the show, I didn't want to leave my seat because I knew if I got up that the spell would be broken. I had so invested my being in the characters on stage that I really felt I was there with them, experiencing all of that. Fabulous experience that as I'm sharing it with you, I'm in the theater. I can see the stage. I can feel the usher coming up and tapping me on the shoulder saying, excuse me, but you have to leave the theater now. years later, I got to do a production of that, a professional production where I actually met my husband. That's 38 years ago. And continued to enjoy Fiddler on the Roof. And then in 1988, for about 6 years, I got into a period where I did Muttle the Tailor and Fiddler on the Roof, over 10 professional productions touring the country, different places around the country. And it was an extraordinary experience. I got to work with the great Theodore Bickel, who was really a giant on so many levels, an Academy Award nominee as well as Tony nominee and president of Actors Equity Association and many unions around the world. Fabulous folk singer, played and sung in like 9 languages. Extraordinary man. Loved him dearly. And the most interesting thing about that whole long experience was that Theo, as we called him, called and asked for me to come up to Cherry County, Cherry County Playhouse in Michigan, to do a production of Fiddler. It was a 3-week production, and I was the only one that he had requested from the group of people that I knew that did the show with him on a regular basis. And I went up there, and I swear to you that I was standing in the wings one night, and I don't know where it came from, but this wind, this feeling, this cool, cold kind of whew came over me. And as I say, I was going through 6 years of doing so many productions of Fiddler, and that wind, and the thought that came with that wind was, this will be the last production of Fiddler on the Roof that you ever do. And it was.
Wow.
all these years later. That's over 20 years ago.
Wow.
And there were times where there were productions. My people and I were talking with different producers, or I would be requested, and for some reason, never came to be. Many of those never. It's the most extraordinary thing that I can relate to in terms of just having this, where I have no idea where it came from, but it was my universe telling me that, okay, you know, you've done it. It's done. Extraordinary. So thanks for asking. That always brings back so many wonderful experiences I've had in my life with that particular property. I don't, you know, I'm not really clear on what that is, but I love the experiences that I take away from it.
And you've been in all different kinds of shows, but one of your most recent ones was Little Shop of Horrors. That had to be just a blast.
It is a blast. It is such a kick to do that show. It's a nice small cast. Everybody is featured so nicely that everybody's invested in it. And as an artist, that's always thrilling. And it's, the score of Alan Menken and I can't remember the Howard Ashman. It was like their first thing. And, of course, people may recall that they've gone on to do Beauty and the Beast and all of those great cartoons for Disney. But it's a great score, and it's a fun show. And it's always nice to do things where audiences laugh and have a good time.
Calvin, what means more to you, to be a Tony Award nominee or to have a successful play like Down from the Mountaintop or the new play that you have, collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat? What means more to you, to be the actor or to be the playwright?
I would say to be the actor, you know. Because I started out as an actor at the age of 5 in Cleveland, Ohio, at a theater called Caramo Theater. And it's always been my love and my passion. I just love the stage. You know, when I'm on the stage, I feel at home. You know, I feel free. It's a strange thing. I feel a lot more alive and free on the stage than I do in life. And so it means everything to me to be an actor. I mean, to be able to share the play, like James Baldwin, Down from the Mountaintop, and Warhol and Basquiat with audiences, it also gives me an enormous amount of pleasure. I toured James Baldwin, Down from the Mountaintop, mostly colleges and universities. That was my intention from the beginning when I wrote it, because I just thought that, you know, this young generation could profit greatly from knowing this man's work, but also writing it, the play, and getting to know Baldwin more just elevated my game as a human being, you know, because of Baldwin just being so deep, he spoke from the language of the heart. And so when you deal in that language, inevitably, hopefully some of it will rub off on you. And so that's what Baldwin has done for me. And that's one of the greatest pleasures for me, is just getting to be more knowledgeable about the human experience, about life and love. In the grand sense, love in the grand sense. But I love sharing it, you know, with audiences, the plays with audiences. And as a playwright, you know, that work hopefully will be around forever for other actors and directors to work with and share with future audiences. But if I had to choose one, I would say acting. Writing is challenging too, but acting is a whole other challenge. And you have this communal experience in acting. When you're on that stage in that theater, and like I spoke of earlier, when you go to a place as the actor, you create a world as an actor, an imaginary world just out of your mind. It's alchemy. Then the audience is right there with you. They have left that theater, and now hopefully they're in that imaginary place. You're all there together, and that's all you know. And so for that brief moment, it's that magical experience that's happening in the imagination, in the spiritual world, where you're all there. And there's nothing else like that. I mean, that is a type of drug that, you know, you have to have once you experience it, yeah, over and over. So,
and if I can just jump in there, I am also a member of the Actors Studio, and I became a member of the Actors Studio probably about 15, 20 years ago in Los Angeles, and most of my experiences were in Los Angeles. I moved back to New York in 2006, and all of a sudden one day there's this African-American actor on stage, and he's going to do a piece that he wrote. I didn't know him, never seen him before, and I'm telling you the next 20 minutes were the most exciting experience I had had. And I'm, you know, Actors Studio in Los Angeles and New York. I've seen a lot of great artists come before the studio and do work. I had never seen anybody do anything that just took me to where this artist was taking me. And it was Calvin doing one of his pieces. And it just blew me away in a wonderfully exciting and extraordinary way that when he shares that performing and being an actor is probably more interesting or more exciting for him than the writing that he does, which, as we know from the part we just read and from other things of his that I've seen, is extraordinary. And there, in its way, his performing is electrifying. And if I may, if you don't mind, in an email that he got from the producer that eventually turned us on to Lonnie Price as our director, Calvin shared with me that the producer wrote, you know, "I'll never forget your electrifying performance in Open Admissions," which is the show Calvin was Tony nominated for. And that's the experience that anyone witnessing Calvin Levels on stage will come away with. It's an exciting and communicative artist who loves being connected to his audience and, as he said, educating them and elevating them to a place that they may not be aware of.
Ira Denmark plays Andy Warhol. Calvin Levels plays John Michel Basquiat. It's called Collaboration, Warhol and Basquiat. It's running from December 2nd through December 22nd at the Here's Main Stage Theater in Soho. You can find out more information about checking it out at here.org.
And you can also go to warholandbasquiat.com, warholandbasquiat.com to find out about it.
Days like this, why I like my job to have you both in the studio. Calvin and Ira, what a pleasure to have you here. Can't wait to see the show. All the best with your careers and with this show, and I know it's going to be a huge success.
Thank you, Doug.
So much, Doug.
Appreciate it.
Really.